had made sure his crew escaped first, earned Arthur's respect instantly, sight unseen. Taillandier explained to Cleaver that, because the Gestapo knew his face and identity, the Englishman could not be allowed to go about the city. "They cut my hair a bit and dyed it black," Cleaver wrote. "Taillandier provided me with an ID card with the name Antoine Broussard, with the words slow-witted on it. If the Germans or police ever entered Mrs. Dessart's home, I was told to speak French with a stutter, that my command of the language was ample enough to pass." Since January 1944, when she'd been identified as a member of the resistance, Dessart had curbed her confrontational demeanor toward the police and the Nazis, not wanting to call so much attention to herself. If any neighbors did recognize her despite her changed appearance, they kept silent. They knew that a visit from Morange awaited anyone who informed on her. For Marie-Louise Dessart, lying low to help American and British airmen remained her mission. It has been estimated that even after her name appeared in the captured notebook, she planned the escapes of at least 110 airmen through the Pyrenees. In April and May 1944, Lieutenant Cleaver was one of the Frenchwoman's top priorities. Every time that she brought Cleaver his meals, or simply entered the annex to chat with him, she took her cat, Miff, with her, either carrying the animal or letting her walk along on a leash. Unlike Arthur, who came and went from 96 Boulevard del Tour every day, Cleaver's confinement meant that he could only move around the annex and Dessart's apartment beneath it. As Cleaver would write in an addendum to his RAF debrief, his stay there mirrored Arthur's in one way. "During my weeks at the house of Françoise Dessart, men and women of all ages came and went from the address. I assumed that they were couriers and other resistance agents and fighters. Mrs. Dessart, while always friendly and solicitous of me, took great pains never to mention any of their names when I was in the same room or even within earshot. I understood the necessity of strict secrecy for the protection of myself and others." Cleaver recalled Taillandier explaining to him that, because matters had become more hazardous since the German occupation of Toulouse, every resistance band had necessarily become more organized and security conscious. In arranging escapes, many pilots and airmen never knew the real names of our handlers and couriers. We simply were handed off to the next link in the escape line chain. Many never even knew the name of their safe housekeeper. Cleaver was never allowed outside, spending most of my days and nights in a comfortable but spartan bedroom in the attic annex of the house. Always the sound of sirens was outside. The wailing sirens were not just air raid alerts. With the rumors of the Allied invasion swelling every day, and with increased sabotage and executions by the resistance, the police and the Gestapo stepped up efforts to arrest suspected resistance fighters and their supporters. At any time of the day or night, the Germans and the police stormed into apartment houses and single homes to mount room-by-room searches. Cleaver wrote, "Numerous times I heard the pounding of Gestapo agents on Mrs. Dessart's front door, and harsh German shouted at her. She spoke some German as well as English, and did not back down from Gestapo men's challenges. They always left her house without searching upstairs, though at those times I was always certain they would rush upstairs and find me." On the streets of Toulouse, Gestapo and police stop and checks turned from routine to incessant. Arthur had never been ordered to produce his photo and papers so often, and each time the Nazis or police hurled question after question at him before they finally accepted that he was deaf and dumb. As with virtually everyone in Toulouse, Arthur was constantly looking over his shoulder. Even though he knew that the Gestapo agent who had trailed him had been removed, he sometimes stiffened when he caught a glimpse of large Gestapo agents who, for a moment, resembled the man who had arrested him. When he shaved at Toulouse's house, he saw the strain in his own face, where there were furrows that had not been there before. He could not help asking Taiyandie when an escape could be arranged. Every time, Taiyandie's only answer was that Arthur needed to be patient and that the moment was coming. As always, it could not come soon enough for Arthur. He got out of bed each day, tucked his photo identification card and papers into his coat pocket, caught the bus to the city center, reported to work at the paint store, and returned to 96 Boulevard del Tour. He worried that with so many stop and checks, the odds were increasing that his luck would run out. In mid-April 1944, Taiyandie appeared at Toulouse's house and told Arthur to come with him to meet Lieutenant Cleaver. Arthur scrambled to put on his coat and followed Taiyandie out the door, the American's spirits rising with the possibility that an escape might be in the works if Taiyandie was introducing him to Cleaver now. Arthur and Taiyandie walked just a few blocks to a red brick apartment house on a dead-end side street and climbed several flights of stairs to the top floor. Taiyandie knocked twice on a scarred wooden door, and it opened a crack to reveal an elderly woman wearing glasses and cradling a gray cat. Nodding at Marcel, she let them in and closed the door quickly. Wordlessly, she took them to another door, opened it, and led them into a cramped passageway and up a creaking stairway to yet another door. She rapped once on it and called out Cleaver's name softly. A bolt on the other side of the door slid open with a rasp, and Marcel, Dessart, and Arthur entered. In the middle of the small annex, not unlike the ones where Arthur had stayed, a wiry man with pale blue eyes and cropped dyed dark hair faced them. He was wearing civilian clothes, and his face still bore bruises and cuts. Arthur walked up to him and shook his hand. Cleaver insisted that Arthur call him Frank. Marcel and Madame Dessart left the two men alone. When Taiyandie came back upstairs to get Arthur, he opened the door to find the two men engrossed in conversation. "Time to leave," Taiyandie said. Disappointment flashed across Arthur's face. The kind of rapport he had quickly developed with Cleaver was exactly what the leader of Morange wanted. Both men would have to rely on each other in their escape attempt, and it would be easier if they liked each other. Throughout late April and into May 1944, Arthur visited Cleaver several times a week. According to Cleaver, Mrs. Dessart, Marcel, and Sergeant Meyerowitz were the only people with whom I conversed for nearly a month. Most of my information about the world outside, such as it was, came from Meyerowitz. He was out and about frequently as Lambert and sometimes went with Marcel to the Frascati. I marveled at how effectively Meyerowitz played his role as a deaf mute. Somehow he fooled the Germans, the police, and even the local crowd time after time. Despite the danger he confronted every time he went out, I envied him a tad. Hidden away as I was, each moment of each day varied between tedium and sudden bursts of fear every time I heard a vehicle pull up near the house. Arthur could relate to all of Cleaver's feelings of isolation, punctuated by sheer anxiety. Cleaver found an escape of sort in the large number of books in Dessart's apartment, remarking that he read more than at any time since my schoolboy years. Marcel hinted at just how fortunate they all were to have Madame Dessart still operating as the chief organizer for the entire resistance escape line in southwestern France. Without her efforts, the southern escape routes might not have been open. Luckily for both Cleaver and Arthur, they had been brought to Toulouse to be helped by the O'Leary line in the south of France. The English and American airmen were even luckier that Marcel had taken a personal interest in getting them out of France. As Arthur and Cleaver's trust and friendship grew, they talked about their lives, about Esther and Dorothy, and other deeply personal matters. Arthur reminded Cleaver in a number of ways of Cleaver's own flight engineer, Sergeant Raymond Hindle. To Cleaver, aside from a bomber's pilot, the most important man aboard is the flight engineer. He knows both the inner and outer workings of the craft as well, if not better, than the pilot, and the training for the job requires both high intelligence and the knack of thinking quickly under the most unimaginable duress. Arthur became comfortable enough with Cleaver to discuss the biggest disappointment in the American's military life, how he had been accepted as a pilot candidate, but had been forced out by an injury. Cleaver was not surprised at all that Arthur had wanted to be a pilot. Aside from his genuine intelligence, as with so many Americans, the lack of university does not reflect a second-rate intellect. His ability to pass himself off as Lambert shows his knack for thinking quickly on his feet and never letting down his guard. Courage and a quick mind were the cornerstone traits of the best pilots. Cleaver remembered that he and Arthur talked without let-up for hours, and credited those conversations with helping him keep his sanity. Jokingly, the pilot wrote that there were days when the only conversation he had was with Miff, the cat. To Cleaver, Arthur detailed how he had come to Toulouse, and how so many brave French men and women had helped him every step of the way. To his utmost credit, Cleaver wrote, he never revealed one name of any man or woman who had aided him. We both knew the necessity for such secrecy. Both the American and the Englishman recounted the events of the nights their planes had been shot down. When Arthur stopped for a moment, he seemed lost in his own private reverie. He then looked at Cleaver and said he only wished that the pilot and co-pilot of his B-24 had behaved as selflessly as I had. Cleaver was genuinely flattered, though surprised by Arthur's vivid description of Lieutenant Philip Chase's conduct as harmful Lil Armful's demise unfolded. Cleaver found Chase's actions unfathomable. It had never occurred to him not to stay in the cockpit as long as possible. He had been trained in the principle that, as with a naval captain, the pilot should be the last man off. I also told him that his pilots merited court-martial for their abysmal performance and cowardice, Cleaver wrote. The crew merited far better. He had no doubt that if Meyerowitz had been able to go through pilot training without injury, he would have behaved far differently than his pilot in January. Both Arthur and Cleaver were united in two purposes: to see their girlfriends and families again, and to get another chance to fight the Nazis. For Arthur, the rumors of the wholesale murder of Jews filled him with a rage he could not fully articulate. He had lost count of how many times he had seen Gestapo agents hauling off men, women, and children simply because they were Juden, Jews. Although most citizens of Toulouse despised the Nazis and Vichy police and would do nothing to help them, a deeply anti-Semitic streak throughout Vichy France led collaborating officials to help the Nazis locate and deport French Jews to the concentration camps. Cleaver's anger toward the Nazis was also personal. London lay in ruins after the Blitz of 1940 to 1941. Tens of thousands of his fellow British men, women, and children dead or maimed. Even now, in the spring of 1944, German buzz bombs, V-1 rockets, and a newer, even more lethal missile, the V-2, indiscriminately rained down and slaughtered people all over England. At the beginning of May 1944, Taillandier repeatedly assured Arthur and Cleaver that the invasion was nearly at hand. The step-up in bombing raids all around the region attested to that welcome news for all three men. However, at the same time, the Germans grew ever more relentless in their search for resistance saboteurs and escaping Allied airmen. Cleaver could hear, and Arthur could see, the increase in Nazi armored cars and troop carriers patrolling the city streets. Every day, Arthur was finding himself stopped and ordered to show his papers. Life in Toulouse grew tenser and more dangerous throughout May, and the Gestapo was planning a brutal crackdown in June against anyone suspected of cooperation with the resistance. At the top of the Nazis' hit list was the mysterious Ricardo. and they were already rounding up and torturing suspicious men and women in an attempt to ferret out the identities of the shadowy resistance leader and his operatives. With things in and around Toulouse guaranteed to worsen once the Allies stormed ashore somewhere in France, Taillandier was determined to get Arthur and Cleaver moving before the invasion. In mid-May, Taillandier brought both sobering and heartening news to Cleaver about his crew. Flight Sergeant and Rear Gunner Donald Hadenot had perished when his parachute failed to open in time. Cleaver hoped that Hadenot's family might find some measure of comfort in the knowledge that he died in the brave performance of his duty. Cleaver learned that Flight Sergeant and Wireless Operator John Franklin and Flight Engineer and Sergeant Raymond Hindle had parachuted safely near Châteauneuf-sur-Charente, buried their parachutes, and been taken in by the local resistance. Taillandier told Cleaver that both of his men had been guided over the Pyrenees to Spain, but the Frenchman did not reveal the names of Cleaver to anyone who had helped the pair. In the final week of May, Taillandier vanished. Toulouse told Arthur that he was not to go out for a few days, but to stay put. After several days went by without Cleaver receiving a visit from Taillandier, and Madame de Sar brushed away the pilot's questions, he began to fear that something had happened to the Frenchman. Arthur worried about the same thing, agonizing that the worst had overtaken his friend, and that he and Cleaver might be left stranded. As it turned out, a British submarine had taken Taillandier and Jeannot to Algiers for a meeting with Colonel Payol to discuss pre-D-Day sabotage operations and ambushes around Toulouse. With the invasion date slated for early June, Taillandier decided on the return trip to France that he could no longer wait to move Arthur and Cleaver. On May 28, 1944, an unnamed female courier delivered a message from Taillandier to both the American and the Englishman. Be ready to move out at any time. For Arthur, relief that Marcel was alive mixed with equal measures of anticipation and nervousness. After nearly 5 months in occupied France, it was time. He was finally getting the chance to escape. Chapter 21. It's time. Taillandier simply could not wait any longer to move Arthur and Cleaver, with the long-awaited Allied invasion of France, Operation Overlord, at hand. The resistance was awaiting their final orders to arrive from London. Secrecy surrounding the invasion site and date was so tight that Payol could not reveal either the location or the date to his top operatives throughout France until literally a few hours before the Allied Armada left ports along the eastern coast of Great Britain. For Arthur and Cleaver, the danger in Toulouse had never been greater. Payol had warned Taillandier that the Germans, alerted by the staggering increase in Allied bombing runs along the entire French coastline, knew the invasion was perhaps just hours away. They just didn't know where. The Gestapo, Abwehr counterintelligence agents, and the police were cracking down harder than ever on the resistance, and rounding up hundreds of people in hopes that someone, anyone, might reveal information about the invasion under torture. That was precisely the reason that even Taillandier and resistance leaders in France itself had not been told where and when the strike would come. In and around Toulouse, Morange was launching increased attacks on German convoys, trains, munition depots, and other military installations. Their intention was to pin down as many troops as possible and prevent them from rushing to whichever coastal spots the Allies invaded. The Gestapo and Vichy police were launching building-to-building searches for resistance safe houses and hidden Allied airmen. The escape routes under the Pyrenees to Spain were hazardous and an arduous trek under the best of circumstances. But now the Germans were scouring every road and every mountain pass for any hint of resistance activity. After a restless night, Arthur arose early in the morning of May 29th, 1944, shaved, bathed, and got dressed. He went downstairs and ate a small breakfast of grapes and bread with Toulouse, who told him that he was not to leave the house and that someone would come for him early in the evening. Arthur went upstairs and packed his few belongings and second-hand clothes in the battered suitcase. He was ready to leave Toulouse. His constant brushes with the Gestapo and police were beginning to chafe at his psyche, as did the memory of his merciless beating by the Gestapo. With luck, he might be able to make it home by his birthday in August. Just after twilight, Toulouse returned from his paint store, and a knock on the door a few minutes later brought Arthur out of a parlor chair and to his feet. Toulouse opened the door, and Taillandier and Jeannot stepped inside quickly. They walked up to him. Although Marcel was someone who was afraid of nothing, there was no mistaking the grim intensity fixed on his features. Jeannot stepped behind a parlor window, opened a shutter an inch or two, and scanned the street. "It's time," Taillandier said. Arthur stared at them for several moments, his emotions churning as he weighed those longed-for words. Nodding, he replied, "I'm ready." He shook Toulouse's hand, thanked him for all he had done, and followed Taillandier and Jeannot outside to a now-familiar black Citroën. Both Frenchmen looked in every direction as Arthur climbed into the back seat. Robert was not at the wheel this time. Instead, the glowering face of André Font peered straight ahead. He was wearing the long black leather overcoat and fedora favored by plain-clothes Gestapo and police. A dark van that Arthur recognized as the same official type used by the Nazis and the police to transport prisoners was parked behind the Citroën. Taillandier and Jeannot got into it and trailed the car as Font pulled away from the curb. Within seconds, Arthur realized they were heading toward the street where Cleaver was hiding. Cleaver was waiting, too. He had received the same message as Arthur. Be ready to move out in the early evening. He opened the annex door in response to a soft but insistent knock from Madame de Sar, and followed her downstairs to the hall of the apartment building. Like Arthur, he was clad in civilian clothes and a beret. Madame de Sar pointed at the Citroën outside. Taillandier got out of the van and into the Citroën, with Font, Arthur, and Cleaver. Font slipped the sedan into gear and pulled away from the curb, followed by the van which Jeannot was driving. No one said a word. Before departing Toulouse, the car and the van made two more quick stops. At a safe house, they picked up a haggard-looking Frenchman who had been jailed for aiding the resistance, escaped, and been taken in by Morange. At another safe house, on the eastern edge of the city, André and Jeannot stopped again, this time to pick up two Belgian men wanted by the Nazis. The pair were pale and trembling as they were loaded into the van with the Frenchmen. Arthur breathed a bit easier as the two vehicles finally left Toulouse behind and swung onto a dirt road winding into the countryside. Then, after 20 minutes, he was surprised when they left the rural road to merge onto a highway. Taillandier turned to the American and the Englishman and told them they were driving 209 kilometers, 130 miles, directly southwest to Perpignan, a city near the Spanish border. If all went well, the trip should take around 2 or 3 hours. Everywhere they looked, German tanks and other armored vehicles were rumbling west along both sides of the highway. The route was safe because Allied bombers were not targeting the plains, foothills, and peaks of the central and eastern Pyrenees, because they were not close enough to the anticipated invasion landing sites on the Atlantic coast. That meant that the Germans were trying to move troops closer to the coast by night, and also that they were searching for any hint of resistance activity between Perpignan and the border. The bombers would wait until the armored columns passed west of Toulouse. If the cars were stopped, Taillandier and Font had forged police papers that would inform the Germans that the car was transporting prisoners to Perpignan for questioning by the Gestapo. In the van behind them, Jeannot, with his German identification documents, would back them up by saying that he was personally transporting additional prisoners with Taillandier and Font. En route to Perpignan, Arthur could make out little of the passing landscape in the darkness, but had a sense of the car climbing upward. The two vehicles slowed down and pulled to the side of the highway three times to stop and pick up four more men, who hopped into the van. Taillandier said that they were four guides for our trek across the mountains. At several German checkpoints, soldiers waved the vehicles to a stop. Turning their flashlights on the occupants, the Germans judged that the haggard passengers were, in fact, prisoners being transported. The forged police papers produced by Font and Jeannot convinced the sentries to let the car and van continue on their way. Finally, lights twinkled ahead of the car. Arthur was correct that their route had started with a climb and had now leveled off. Much of the drive from Toulouse to Perpignan wound through the foothills and ridges of the approaches to the hulking Pyrenees. Perpignan was a city some 300,000 people on the Roussillon plain. 8 miles from the Mediterranean Sea and 18 miles from the Spanish border. Even in the darkness, Arthur could make out the looming mass of foothills and mountains between the city and the border. They drove deep into the city and stopped at its southernmost fringe at one of the modest stucco homes that appeared to be the type virtually everyone in the city lived in. As soon as the two vehicles entered a garage and parked, Taillandier led Arthur and Cleaver into a bulkhead at the rear of the house and into a dank, musty basement cluttered with stacked wood, old furniture, and a heap of old blankets in one corner. Just before descending through the bulkhead, Arthur had taken another quick glimpse at the towering mass of the Pyrenees, wondering again how they were supposed to get over them. He told himself that Taillandier knew what he was doing, and that if other escapees had made the trek, he could manage it as well, no matter how grueling. When the Frenchman and the two Belgians piled into the cellar, followed by the four guides, Arthur and Cleaver were both dismayed at the two Belgians' behavior. They seemed to be arguing with each other and with one of the guides. Taillandier glared at them and they shut up, but continued to shoot angry glances at the guide. Taillandier ordered everyone to get as comfortable as they could and be ready to move out before dawn. They would have to risk daytime travel to the foothills, as the Germans were stopping every vehicle that tried to head out at night for the mountain approaches. In the past, they would have risked the nighttime passage, but the Germans' heightened alertness in late May and early June had resulted in several failed escapes by resistance members and Allied airmen. If they were challenged in the daylight, as they probably would be, Jeannot and Font would bluff that Arthur, Cleaver, and the rest of the passengers were informers leading them to suspected safe houses near the border. If the bluff failed, the three Morange men would have to try to shoot their way out of it. Arthur would not hesitate to use his pistol against the Germans. In the evasion classes in which he had learned what measures to take while attempting to escape the Nazis, Arthur and the others had been instructed that if they were captured in civilian clothes, they were to identify themselves as Allied airmen and invoke the Geneva Convention for treatment of POWs. They were strongly warned, however, that if the Gestapo seized them in civilian clothes and they were holding or concealing a gun, they would probably be executed on the spot. As Arthur lay beneath an oily, rancid wool blanket that made every exposed part of his hands and neck itch, he reflected on those classes and the warning about a gun. No matter what, he decided, he would hang on to the pistol. If things went bad tomorrow, the Germans would probably kill them all anyway, and if that were to happen, he intended to take as many Nazis with him as he could. Alongside him, Cleaver did not say a word that night, lost in his own thoughts, shifting his position against the stone wall and atop the dirt floor from time to time. The Frenchman and the four guides were propped against the wall, a few of them snoring. The two Belgians whispered and muttered to each other all night, one of them a sallow-looking man with an almost feral face, the other a thin man whose unkempt, gaunt appearance testified that he had been through some grim ordeal. Arthur was tempted to tell both of them to shut up or even smack the one with the pallid face, but finally ignored them. A loud engine and grinding gears alarmed everyone in the cellar around 4:30 a.m. The Belgians began shouting, and this time Arthur hissed at them to shut their mouths. In French, one of the guides growled the same at the pair. Arthur waited for the crunch of hobnailed Nazi boots outside, and the sound of the bulkhead doors being pried open. The doors did in fact open, but all that came down the steps of the cellar was Taillandier's voice, telling them to come outside quickly and to leave any baggage in the cellar. Arthur sprinted for the stairs with only his coat, his identification papers, and his pistol. Cleaver was right behind him, his presence a reassuring one. As the men spilled from the cellar, Taillandier pointed to a large, mud-stained, open-backed truck with wooden posts and rails on each side. They ran to the back and climbed into it. One of the guides took the wheel next to Font and Jeannot. Taillandier sprang into the back and sat next to Arthur against the rails. On his other side was Cleaver. The truck lumbered into motion, a dark, oily puff of smoke rising from the engine, and clattered off down a rough dirt road whose every bump sent the men in the back banging against each other. They were scarcely a few minutes on their way toward the foothills when one of the guides, a short, square-shouldered man whose weather-burnished face made it impossible to tell if he was 30 or 60, asked Taillandier something in French. In an almost annoyed tone, Taillandier replied. Whatever he said caused the two Belgians to erupt in a torrent of words, pointing at the thick, fur-lined boots the guide was wearing and at a satchel he was carrying. The guide had asked Taillandier where the boots, walking sticks, and heavy hiking socks, hats, and sweaters for the escapees were. Taillandier had told him that they should be stockpiled at the safe house in the foothills, where they would spend the evening. One baleful look from Taillandier silenced the Belgians, but they still whispered back and forth, shooting furtive glances at Taillandier and shaking their heads. Arthur glared at the two men. As the truck pitched along one dirt and rock-strewn road after another, the route was not directly toward the foothills ahead of them, but appeared to track alongside the mountain range, never turning directly to the peaks. Several times German fighter planes passed high overhead, but did not swoop down. The planes were only tracking vehicles or parties on foot if they were moving straight at the foothills, not along them. After several hours, the truck still had not made that turn. Chapter 22. Misery in the Mountains. Around 1 p.m. on May 31st, the farm truck rattled to a stop some 8 hours after setting out to the west of Perpignan. A highway viaduct rose from the rim of a forested valley and toward the craggy foothills of the Pyrenees. Taillandier jumped from the truck's open bed, and the rest of the men followed. The guides took them to a tiny clearing beneath one of the viaduct's mammoth steel and concrete arches. They were told that they must all wait there till nightfall because German patrols and aircraft scoured the area between the valley and passes through the foothills to the mountains from dawn to dusk. As they sipped water from canteens and munched on hard cheese and bread, all they could do was wait for darkness. Throughout the long day, they tensed up every time a fighter plane droned overhead, or the road atop the viaduct shook from approaching troop carriers. The guides instructed the escapees to try to rest as much as they could. Any hope they had of eluding the Germans hinged upon reaching the foothills under cover of darkness, and making it as far as the mountain approach the guides had selected. While the weather had been warm in the early afternoon, the air began to change within a few hours. The temperature was dropping close to the mountains. To pass the time before nightfall, the men began to talk in low voices and to swap stories. The guides listened, sometimes chuckling at a joke or an anecdote, but the two Belgians said nothing, frowning. Arthur, able to follow French conversations enough to get the gist of what was being said, had Cleaver translate anything he had a hard time understanding. When Taillandier and the others turned to Arthur, he relied upon Cleaver's fluent, finishing-school French to regale the Frenchman with the descriptions of the colorful characters and incidents from his Bronx neighborhood. Street-hardened André and Jeannot, who both might have deemed Cleaver a snob before the war, were now mesmerized as he told not only Arthur's stories, but also described nail-biting flights to aid the resistance. The Frenchman's eyes glinted with respect for the RAF pilot and American airmen who had put their lives in jeopardy for the French people. Even the reserved Cleaver was captivated by the stories of Taillandier's daring missions and narrow escapes. On one of Morange's most audacious ambushes, Taillandier and a hand-picked hit team had donned stolen police uniforms, stopped a three-car Gestapo motorcade several miles outside of Toulouse, and in a flurry of submachine gun and shotgun fire, cut down a notorious SS colonel named Wilhelm Messick, his French mistress, Paulette Bordier, and several Gestapo agents and collaborators. It was a message assassination that made Ricardo the most wanted man in Toulouse, but one whose identity remained a mystery to the Nazis. One thing in which Taillandier, Font, and Jeannot all evinced pride was that no Morange operative captured and tortured by the Gestapo had ever given up their comrades. Several had killed themselves before the Gestapo could break them. Left unsaid was that the tough Frenchmen trusted Arthur and Cleaver to uphold the same Morange credo. As night came on and the growls of the German fighters' engines ceased, the guides rose at the same time. Jeannot and Font walked up to Arthur and Cleaver and embraced them. Without a word, they stepped out of the sheltered clearing when a Citroën pulled up along the adjoining dirt road and flashed its headlights. Font, who turned briefly to meet Arthur's eyes, nod and flash a tight approving smile, the first hint of anything except taciturn toughness he had ever shown the airmen, got inside with Jeannot. They were gone in seconds. The guides led Arthur, Taillandier, Cleaver, and the other three men onto a woodland path only wide enough for the men to walk single file. Each guide had reached into his knapsack and put on a hat, a sheepskin coat, thick socks, and mountain boots. From those bags, each had pulled out a small carbine and slung it over a shoulder. In complete silence except their own breathing and the crunch of their shoes against dirt and leaves, the procession wound higher and higher until the viaduct was far beneath them, a distant sliver in the moonlight. Already Arthur's lungs were starting to burn. Cleaver was also breathing hard. If these were just the foothills, how bad would the mountains be? Every pilot and airman who had attempted the climb had asked the very same question. All came up with the same answer. A nightmare that could only be worse if the Germans spotted them. Pyrenees guides taking men through the passes preferred moonless nights, trusting their own knowledge of every twist, every turn, every fissure along the route. German Alpine troops camped throughout the mountains and, when the moon shone, scanned the passes and peaks with binoculars for any sign of men or movement. Arthur, Cleaver, and the other escapees were growing more concerned with how ill-prepared they were for the climb. They had been whisked in such haste from Toulouse that there had been no time to properly outfit them with warm attire, hiking boots, or even gloves. Although they were still far below the actual mountains, their feet and hands were stinging from the gathering cold and starting to go numb. They kept moving, laboring for each breath the higher they climbed, and hoping that the mountain gear and clothing Tian Dia had promised would be at the first shelter. Tian Dia shared their misery, knowing that it was not the guide's job to provide clothing and footwear for escape parties. That was the task of the resistance, but with the crackdown in Toulouse, there had been no time. Arthur lost all track of time. He just kept one foot moving in front of the other as the group inched up narrow paths, stretching ever higher into the foothills. At some point, he was not even sure when, every step was into deepening snow. The air grew colder and thinner. Arthur's hands had gone from a painful throb to complete numbness, and his fingers were swollen and a deep shade of scarlet. Below the snow line, icy groundwater had seeped through his work boots. Now, ankle-deep snow filled them. One thing did not change, except to intensify. Despite the cold, the pain that ripped through his back felt like flames. His hatred of the Nazis and a desire for the chance to kill more of them prodded Arthur up the frigid trails. So too did loyalty and love for the French who were helping him. Along with all that was his determination to return to Esther and his family. The guides did not allow them to halt even once. Canteens filled with water were passed up and down the line from time to time, with a warning that each man take only a sip. Gulping it could cause already oxygen-deprived lungs to expand and contract so violently that a climber could suffer a seizure or worse. As they trekked through shin-deep snow up paths discernible only to the guides, streaks of gray began to pierce the inky night sky. The guides stopped as the gray tinges turned lighter. Grateful to stand still even for a moment, Arthur and the other hikers spotted a long, gabled farmhouse with an ancient barn just ahead. One of the guides pointed at the structure and headed toward it. The others trudged behind him. They had reached their first safe house just minutes before sunrise. Once they were inside the abandoned farmhouse, the guides told the men that they could not light the fireplace for fear of attracting squads of German Alpine troops searching for escapees and resistance members in the passes. Smoke from a vacant old home was a dead giveaway. They could not even dry out their sodden clothes with a fire. Even worse, there were no mountain boots, warm clothes, caps, or any gear except walking sticks. All the furniture in the house was long gone, but several thick wool blankets were strewn across the floor. Several of the guides disappeared for a few minutes and returned with armfuls of dry hay from the barn. They laid the piles on the floor. Arthur, Cleaver, Tian Dia, the Belgians, and the other Frenchmen stripped off their coats, shirts, trousers, and socks. Then they wrapped themselves in the blankets, made makeshift mattresses with the hay, used the remainder to place their clothes atop in the hope that it would absorb some of the wetness, and slumped on the floor on top of their beds. In French, with Tian Dia translating for Arthur, a guide told them that even though the group had traveled as a unit so far, the next day they would split up into pairs, with two men per guide. They would travel by night along trails hopefully not used by the Nazis, and reassemble at the next resting place the following morning. Tian Dia nodded at Arthur to let him know that he would travel with him in Cleaver, the only group with three instead of two per guide. Chapter 23. One of the worst days in my life. When Arthur awoke in the afternoon, every muscle in his body ached. The party rested until just before dusk, and while the guides had no heavy clothing to offer the escapees, they did have several days' portions of hard biscuits, equally hard cheese, and dried fruit for each man. Though the portions were scanty, they would have to suffice. They were also handed two leather flasks, each one smeared with sheep fat to prevent cracking or freezing in the mountain chill. One flask contained water, and could be refilled along the way by simply scooping snow into the opening. The second flask held brandy, and they were urged to use it sparingly, only when the cold seemed unbearable. They were warned that drinking any of it before sleeping was a complete waste, as the liquor was meant to be used on the trail. Each man was provided with a walking stick for support wherever the trails narrowed, and one misstep could send a climber hurtling thousands of feet into a valley or a ravine. The route the party was to follow cut from the central Pyrenees to the eastern edge of the range, from the Aran Valley, above which the old farmhouse was perched, to the Col du Sampour Pass. One of only three major passes across the mountains to Spain, Sampour would not have been the guide's first choice under normal conditions. The easiest route would have been directly across the eastern edge of the chain from Perpignan to Figueres, the closest Spanish town to the border crossing. But the Germans had choked off virtually all chances of escaping that way, forcing the resistance to attempt escapes on a hazardous course winding eastward from the central Pyrenees. If escape parties could have stayed on the pass for the entire journey, their odds would have increased. However, the Germans patrolled the trail day and night with Alpine troops who carried skis and long-range sniper rifles. Henschel 126 scout planes, whose narrow wingspan and small fuselage made them ideal for maneuvering through breaks between the peaks, flew less than 50 feet above the trails. Even worse for Arthur and the others, the aircraft were equipped with powerful lights that allowed them to scout the passes in the darkness. The guides would have to rely on their knowledge of little-used paths off the main trail for any hope of getting Arthur, Cleaver, and the rest of the party to safety in eastern Spain. As dusk neared, the guides imparted final instructions to their charges. They were not to stop unless ordered to do so by their individual guide. If they had to relieve themselves, they were to find a rock to go behind. No matter where they were in the pass or on a side path, the line had to keep moving. If a man did find a boulder behind which he could urinate or defecate, it was his job to catch up with the rest. The guides warned them not to leave their extremities exposed for too long in the bone-chilling night air. Their route was to take them up and down some of the Pyrenees' highest peaks, some as high as 11,000 feet. The moment they heard a Henschel scout plane, whose drone sounded like a loud washing machine, they were told to fling themselves into the deep snow on the trail, behind a boulder, or flatten themselves against a rocky wall. The guides knew the likeliest spots where Alpine troops encamped along the pass, and tried to lead the party along goat paths and hidden routes known only to locals. Some of these paths, the guides warned, were less than 2 feet wide. The snow would be deep everywhere until they approached the eastern edge of the Pyrenees, and tonight's passage would pose constant hardship because the northern-facing French slopes of the chain were blanketed by snow deep enough for skiers until late June. The last warning from the guides was the most sobering. If they did not reach the next safe house by sunrise, the Germans would undoubtedly spot them in the daylight. Shortly after dusk, the first party, that of the two Belgians, set out with two guides. With Jeannot and Font gone, there was one more guide than was needed. Taillandier, having mulled over the Belgians' difficult behavior, decided that two guides might be necessary to keep them moving. Arthur, Cleaver, and Taillandier went out next, a half hour later, with their guide, a small, compact man named Emile. His movements were quick and sure, inspiring confidence that he knew every inch of the route. Snow was falling heavily, an ominous obstacle in their quest to reach their next stop before daybreak. Their first steps proved slow and difficult. No matter how much Arthur and Cleaver wished that they had boots, gloves, a hat, and a thick coat like Emile, it did not matter. They headed up a trail one behind the other, Emile at the head, Cleaver next, Arthur third, and Taillandier at the rear. The moon lay hidden behind glowering dark skies. As the path steepened, an opening a few hundred feet ahead loomed between two jagged peaks. They needed nearly an hour to plod through knee-deep snow to reach the gap, and when they did, a stunningly beautiful and terrifying panorama greeted them. The pass itself, though covered in snow, was wide. At one edge, however, was a cirque, a sheer drop of several thousand feet to a tree-lined valley that was framed by a semicircle of near-perpendicular cliffs. Despite the frigid temperature, torrents of water, called gav, gushed downward from fissures in the cliffs, the noise like that of hundreds of fire hoses turned on at once. The pass continued upward, the track forcing every man to lean forward with all his weight on his walking stick. The energy expended in climbing just a few feet was harder than any of the physical tests Arthur had endured during pilot training. The freezing air made every breath a torment. Except for the guide, everyone battled vertigo, the heights so disorienting that the men constantly felt that they were lurching to either side. The mental strain was as bad as the physical. The realization that even one slip or stumble could send you plunging down into ravines or the valley caused hesitation with every step. As Arthur inched along, his fingers and toes on fire, the likelihood of frostbite grew. Arthur and his companions listened during every step of their route for the unmistakable drone of the Henschel 126 scout plane. With no sense of time, he was not sure if the clatter of the plane's single engine came an hour or several hours into the trek. As the noise grew louder and the plane's beacon flashed across the pass, he dove behind a boulder as instructed. The scout plane buzzed no more than 50 feet above them, with its light sweeping the trail. The men lay flat in the snow or behind the boulders and waited for the craft to make another pass, with no way of knowing if they had been spotted. If Henschel's had not been too lightweight to carry a cumbersome machine gun, Arthur and the others might have already been cut down. At least 10 minutes passed. The plane was apparently not coming back. The guide pushed himself off the trail, brushed the snow off his clothes, and took a step. Suddenly he flung himself back down, and the others, who had just started to climb back to their feet, flopped back into the snow as well. The Henschel swooped back above the trail, the beacon illuminating the pass, and vanished again. The party lay in the snow for a short time, and as soon as the guide stood up again, they followed his lead. Whether or not they had been discovered, they had to move out again immediately. If the German pilot was already radioing their position, their only chance was to reach the safe house before the German troops searched the pass in daylight. They stayed on the pass, having lost at least a half hour because of the scout plane, leaving no time for the guide to escort them to the safe house by circuitous back trails before sunrise. Fear sent a rush of adrenaline through Arthur and the other men, and while he could not completely ignore the pain in his hands and feet, he kept pushing forward, keeping Cleaver's back in sight, and fighting the impulse to look down at the sheer drops from the pass. The sky began to lighten. Emil veered from the pass and through a fissure, nearly invisible to the naked eye, but just wide enough for a man to push through. Behind the fissure and shielded by a granite outcrop, stood a small stone lean-to known only to local mountain climbers. They had made it after what Arthur would call one of the worst days in my life. They staggered inside the windowless shelter to find the Belgians and their two guides shouting at each other. As the Belgians yelled and pointed fingers at the guide, one of the guides explained to Taillandier that the pair did not want to go on, and that if they did want to continue, the guides were demanding more money than the resistance had agreed upon. The Belgians declared that they wanted to turn back to hide and wait for warmer weather. Taillandier argued that they were halfway to Spain, and that the distance was roughly the same in the cold either way. Still, they were determined to turn back at nightfall the following day. For a time, Taillandier tried to persuade them to reconsider, warning them that the Gestapo had already begun an unprecedented crackdown on the resistance and escapees. They were as good as dead if they turned back now, he warned. The debate stopped for a few minutes as the Frenchman and his guide stumbled into the hut just as the horizon lightened. Then the Belgians went at Taillandier again, and utterly refused to continue into Spain. The Belgians tried to convince the rest of the group to turn back with them, insisting that the journey was suicidal with so many Germans in the mountains and too many dangers posed by the snow and the cold. Although Arthur could commiserate about the cold, his fingers and toes were grotesquely swollen. There was nothing anyone could say to make him turn back. He knew without asking that Cleaver felt the same. From the scornful expression on Taillandier's face, it was clear that he agreed wholeheartedly with Arthur. Cleaver wrote, "The Belgians did not want to continue and wanted to turn back. They refused to change their minds. I thought them utter fools. We were closer to freedom, so why go back when we were getting closer to Figueres?" Though neutrality in World War II Spain was an ambiguous term, Figueres was the closest major town to the French border, which was roughly 24 miles away. It was also a place whose population had fiercely battled Franco's army during the Spanish Civil War, and loathed his ties to Hitler. The townspeople sympathized with the Allies and aided the resistance and Allied escapees. Arthur, Cleaver, and the Frenchman bluntly declined the offer to head back with the Belgians. Enraged that no one supported them, the two men cursed Taillandier and stepped toward him in an aggressive way. Arthur and Cleaver moved immediately to his side. As one of the men lunged at Taillandier, Arthur stepped in front of him and drove a hard right hand into his face. The man staggered to his knees, but quickly got back up and swung at Arthur. Arthur blocked the punch with his left arm, stepped closer to the Belgian, and delivered a short and swift right to his stomach. The Belgian gasped and sank to his knees. This time he did not get up, with Arthur standing over him with both fists clenched. Cleaver had grabbed the other Belgian and pinned his arms. Whether it was Taillandier's contemptuous, chilling glare, or the obvious intent of the American and Englishmen to protect him, the Belgians stopped struggling. Arthur let the man get up off the floor. Cleaver released the other. The Belgians backed away to a corner and sat on the earthen floor against a wall. Two of the guides agreed to take them back down the way they had come. For Arthur and Cleaver, the choice was simple. They preferred to die attempting to escape than to return to Nazi-infested Toulouse or the countryside. Later, Emile, through Taillandier, told Arthur and Cleaver that if they were not spotted and if they maintained their nightly pace, they could reach Figueres in a day and a half, two at the most. Of course, that depended on the weather and the roadblocks they encountered. As Arthur lay against a wall and tried to close his eyes, he realized he had not sipped his brandy even once yet. Hoping that the liquor might warm up his hands and feet at least a little, he drank just a tiny shot, reveling in the fiery warmth that slid down his throat and into his growling stomach. For a few welcome minutes, the liquor did seem to help. He sank into a deep, dreamless sleep. Chapter 24 Parting Ways. Near 10 o'clock on the morning of June 2, 1944, Taillandier woke up Arthur and Cleaver with a gentle shake of their shoulders. The only sounds inside the lean-to were the snores and groans of the other men, who were scattered across the floor in deep, weary sleep. Wispy clouds of frost swirled above each man with every breath. Crouching in front of the American and the Englishman, Taillandier told them in a hushed tone that he would not be accompanying them on the final leg of the journey. He had kept this to himself. Matters in Toulouse required his immediate presence, but he assured them that in Spain, arrangements to receive the Marcel Jeannot party had been made. Still, simply reaching Spain did not ensure freedom. Taillandier warned them again. Even though the country was technically neutral, the fascist regime of General Francisco Franco identified with Hitler's Germany. Spanish authorities not only turned the other way when Gestapo agents kidnapped Allied escapees and took them back to occupied France,